Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. The fashion world lost one of its greats this week with the death of Andre Leontali at age 73. Obituaries used words like pioneering, iconic, and visionary to describe his career and the man. He was often the first and only black man in the room. And Anna Wintour, his former boss at the magazine Vogue, described him in a letter as, quote, magnificent and erudite and wickedly funny, mercurial too. Actress Kerry Washington tweeted, "Oh, Andre, heaven is going to be too fabulous now. Sir, you blessed us with your charm, wit, and taste for the exceptional. You'll shine so brightly from the heavens that we'll know what true stardom looks like. We'll gaze up at you always in awe and with gratitude." Andre Leontali's career took off as Paris bureau chief of Women's Wear Daily, and his legacy was cemented as creative director and editor-at-large of Vogue. In the introduction to his memoir, The Chiffon Trenches, he wrote, "I was a fixture, a force, and a fierce advocate of fashion and style." Andre Leontali joined us in 2020 when the book was published. In his honor, we wanted to share some of that interview again throughout the show. First, we'll hear from him as he talks about his upbringing in the segregated South, Durham, North Carolina, and the values his church and his grandmother instilled in him. I asked him what were those values that had served him well, both personally and professionally.
Discipline, maintenance, honor, faith, structure, and kindness, humility, and empathy. Those are the things that I learned from my grandmother. She set the role. She was a great role model. She was very humble, humility, yet she was very strong. And through the lessons imposed upon me from my upbringing, she raised me right, and I do not regret it, and it lives with me today. Manners, uprightness, cleanliness, scrubbing, waxing floors, wonderful laundry, mm-hmm. beautiful sheets, air-dried sheets, starched sheets, etc., etc. I learned all my lessons from my grandmother in her house, and faith, and we went to church every Sunday. We had a family. The church what I grew up in was a family church founded by my ancestors. So the collective consciousness of the ancestral recall has permeated everything I've ever done in every moment of my existence and every day as I walk through the trenches of chiffon of life. In general, as I walk through the trenches, I have to have something to propel me into triumph, and this is what it is: faith, structure, humility, honor, dignity.
Now, you said something interesting there. For people who don't know what it means for a Southern grandmother to raise you right, can you explain what raise you right means?
Raising you right is simply giving you the values that are important to be able to sustain oneself through the adult life and through career, family. Raising right means that you're guided along the straight and narrow. Raising right means that you show manners to your elders, you show respect to your neighbors, you are kind to your neighbors, you show humility, and you show a responsibility. You have a moral code to be part of a community that totally responds to you, and you respond and you give out to the community, and you are generous and you are kind. The most important thing is that you are kind and you have a Christian charity towards humankind.
My guess is Andre Leontali, the name of his memoir is The Chiffon Trenches. Now, were there any life lessons that you learned during that time that didn't serve you because they were for a time and they were a certain generation grew up?
No. It passes down from generation to generation. Generational. This is non-generational. These are values that humans, if you're lucky enough to have them. Listen, I could have gone down the wrong path. I could have ended up being a gangster or a thug or not having gone to college. I mean, I didn't pursue those things, and it didn't happen to me. But you just never know. You have to have someone to raise you right. Right is depending, is relative to the individual. So I don't know how to express it. That right is just right. It's not something that you really can define, give it a definition based on book, on a book, or it's not a Webster's definition. Raise right is it relates to all people, Chinese people, black people, white people, Spanish people, Puerto Rican people. Raise right is a very important aspect of getting on with your life and your career. You were brought up right, it will follow you through your life.
In the book, your faith comes up repeatedly. How did your faith, or did your faith, I don't want to assume this, how did your faith help you in the world of fashion, or was that a separate part of your life?
No, I always had it with me. I didn't wear it on my sleeve, but it was always internal, and it always gave me the strength. I always had the structure of my faith. I always went to church. I didn't go to church that much in Paris. I did go to churches in Paris, of course, but on a regular basis, I'm in church once a week on Sundays, regularly, and that is an important moment in the week in my life. On a Sunday morning, the ritual of church is a very strong aspect of my life as an African-American man who was brought up in the Missionary Baptist Church. I grew up in a small family church. I go to the Abyssinian Baptist Church on 138th Street and Odell Clark Place in New York, the oldest African-American church in the state, the great state of New York. It's 211 years old this year, maybe 212. Forgive me if I don't have the exact age of the church, but it is a very strong church. Going to church, the sanctuary, you will be renewed through the sermon, the songs, the prayer, the reading of the word. There is something in the church that you just, you can't put your hands on it. When you leave the church, you will leave the church a stronger person, a renewed person, even though you might have had some ups, some downs during the week. But when you come out of the church, you feel renewed.
Part of what you're describing please continue.
No, I'm sorry. Sorry. You go
ahead. Part of what I'm listening to when I hear you talking about, it's a lot of it, of course, is faith, but it's also ritual. The ritual of doing something?
A ritual is everything. Ritual is part of a time on it. Routine is strong in one's life, is structure. Ritualistic is the church going. Ritualistic is, for instance, getting up and deep cleaning your apartment once a week. If you say you get up on a Monday, I have a friend, she gets up on Monday and she cleans her whole apartment. That's what she does on Monday during the pandemic. Another friend gets up on Fridays and cleans. So this is a ritual, and these rituals, these life chores, give you a structure, and that structure helps you to survive. You don't survive in chaos. You survive in order. There's order. The church and your faith gives an order to your life. It gives you a very strong sense of order and organization.
What are rituals in the fashion industry that are important?
Some of the rituals that are important are deportment or good behavior, politeness, a kind of strong camaraderie or kinship when you find a designers that somehow their clothes respond to you, and you can build friendships over the years. I've built great friendships. Ralph Lauren, Carolina Herrera, Oscar De La Renta, Michael Kors. These are friendships that I've built and nurtured over years, decades and decades of time. And it's not just because they have designed a beautiful dress, but we all have become friends because we have a certain kind, we are aligned because of our mutual interests in beauty, decor, gardens, music, opera, literature, dance, etc., etc.
Why are all of those things you mentioned important in a time like we're living through right now?
Because it will sustain you. It simply sustains you. It gives you sustenance. It gives you substance. You must have these things as motivation. Reading books. Whenever I get a book, an Amazon package arrives as a book, it's like Christmas morning through the pandemic. I'm only getting books in my house. I get books every other day, and the books are what sustain me. You know, I'm reading Susan Sontag's great biography, a Pulitzer Prize-winning book that recently got the Pulitzer Prize. I'm reading Andy Warhol's great 900-page biography, by Blake Gopnik. And these are the things that sustain you. You must always be curious. Curiosity is a prime point in being able to survive, because when you're curious, you learn something new every day. And I read this beautiful biography of Susan Sontag. I remember the author's name. He's a German man. It was translated into English. But it's just an extraordinary biography, because she had the structure of literature as a young child. She was reading already the great classics. By the age of 14, she was reading Thackeray, Dickens, and this is what made her the great intellectual thinker that she was, that she became. So it's ritual. You know, you have something. If you love art, if you love painting, if you love music, you just must steep yourself in those disciplines, and, you know, they will give you strength to go forward and inspire you.
That was part of my conversation with Andre Leontali, the former Vogue creative director who died on Tuesday. He was 73. We'll hear more from my interview with Andre Leontali about his entrance into the fashion world and his experience as one of its rare black editors. This is All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. The world of fashion is mourning the loss of Andre Leontali, who passed away on Tuesday at the age of 73. On Instagram, designer Diane von Furstenberg wrote, "Goodbye, darling Andre. No one saw the world in a more elegant and glamorous way than you did. No one was more soulful and grander than you were. The world will be less joyful now." Before becoming a fixture of the fashion world, the former creative director for Vogue had originally studied to be a French teacher. In my interview with him in 2020, around the release of his memoir, The Chiffon Trenches, Talley told me that he was dissuaded from that path only when his applications to teaching positions at schools were all rejected. His French would still be useful to him, though, when he became Paris bureau chief of Women's Wear Daily later on. In our interview, Talley spoke about that pivot from French to fashion and his time in Paris in the 1970s and other reflections on his career. Here's my conversation, starting with that moment that Talley decided to enter fashion.
I wanted to be a French teacher because that's what I went to Brown's for, to study, and I thought that would be the right career move. And then when I wrote 200 letters to schools, private boarding schools, and didn't get a position, then I thought it was not the right thing, because the 200 letters were rejecting letters, and I was always interested in fashion. And so my friend said, "Come to New York. You should really be in fashion, because that's what your love is, your passion is." And I followed them, and I had a great friend who was an instructor, an art professor at the Rhode Island School of Design. Mm-hmm. He's deceased, is Richard Merkin. He was a great friend. He was a great painter. And he said, "You have to come to New York, because where your passion is fashion. And forget about this teaching thing." And so I said, okay. And then I got to New York, and I met Deanna Vreeland. I volunteered for her for 6 weeks. And then Mrs. Vreeland saw in me what I didn't see in myself, and she recommended me to Andy Warhol, and I worked at the factory. That was my first job. Mrs. Vreeland was the mentor that made the difference.
Andre, when you were an editor at Women's Wear Daily and you were living in Paris, what was different about the way the fashion industry operated in Paris as compared to New York, and how was it different for you as a black man?
Oh, Paris was the mecca of fashion, and is to this day. Paris was the mecca, the Holy Grail. And you went to Paris for the true, true great moments, the great creators, the great designers, the titans. You went to a world that is unique. It's larger than life. It's excellence. It stands for excellence and high creativity. And so for me, as a black man going to Paris, when I was the only one in 1978 sitting on the front row at an Yves Saint Laurent collection, watching this beautiful collection unfurl, where he had been inspired by Porgy and Bess, the Gershwin classic folk opera, this just came home to me. I felt right at home, because my first big show in Paris was the Yves Saint Laurent Porgy and Bess runway couture collection. The music was played, and Leontine Price singing Summertime, and the clothes, the attitude of the clothes, where the clothes were so akin to what I'd seen, you know, black women wear in my church. The attitude, not the same kind of clothes, not as expensive, but there was just an attitude, the gestures, the way the women wore their hats, with the veils, the way they wore their scarves, their chiffon scarves. the colors and everything. So Paris was the Mecca. When you went to Paris, you went to the mountaintop. When you were in New York covering fashion, fashion could be exciting, but fashion in America in those days, in the 70s, was about bread and butter. It was more commercially oriented, yet there were some great sparks of creativity in the work of Ralph Lauren, Oscar de la Renta, Bill Blass, and Calvin Klein. But you just had a different emotional response to Paris as you did to New York. In New York, it was very, very, very bread and butter, very much, we are selling clothes here. We are very pragmatic. But in Paris, you could have the most luxurious presentations of clothes that simply were out of this world, clothes that cost, you know, upwards of $30,000 to $40,000, $50,000. And they were unique, and that is a world that exists still today. That is a cultural world. It is a cultural world. There is a society that requires those kind of dresses, you know. The Saint Laurent and Chanel dresses, people buy those clothes who are wealthy. That is part of their culture and their lifestyle. Also, I do think that America is a very important place for fashion. It's not to be underrated, and there is always excitement. I really particularly think the work of Ralph Lauren and Carolina Herrera and Oscar de la Renta are outstanding in the world of fashion today. I'm speaking of 2020. And also Marc Jacobs. Marc Jacobs is an extraordinary, unique talent in the world of fashion.
Now, Andre, over the course of your career, you had the experience of being the one and only black person in the room in this conversation about certain things. Two-part question. When was a time in your career that you spoke up, that you knew it made a difference? And when was a time that now you look back and you thought, you know what, I should have spoken up?
Well, there's no time when I think back that I should have spoken up and I didn't. I spoke up in quiet ways. I was a quiet advocate. I did speak up, and I was quiet when Jennifer Hudson finally reached the cover of Vogue, when she was in the movie Dreamgirls, and she won an Oscar, and she won the Golden Globe. She won an Oscar for Best Supporting Actress. I went to 10 screenings of the movie before Christmas of the year it came out, and I kept quietly sending emails to my boss, Anna Wintour, that people would stand up and cheer in the theaters the way people stand up at football games and cheer when someone makes a touchdown. And I experienced this over 10 times, including Christmas Day, and that was a time when I made a difference and Jennifer got on the cover. I did not run into Anna Wintour's office and say, you must put Jennifer Hudson on the cover. She's great. It was a very distinct message that this girl was going to get the Oscar for Best Supporting Actress and the Golden Globes because of the anthem she sang, that great song. And that song became an anthem for her. And I think that was a very significant time. I also think that although I was not, it was not an advocate, but when I was assigned to do the first cover of our first African-American First Lady, Michelle Obama, that was the time when I made the difference at Vogue. I was assigned it, I went through it, I did it, and I was proud of it. Proud of it.
You know, you write about a lot of your friendships and your relationships, Karl Lagerfeld, for example. And I was curious, you know, Karl Lagerfeld could be very cruel about weight. And you write about your own experiences being judged for your weight in this particular industry. Looking back, why were people so easily mean about those kind of things, not just to you, but in general?
I think that's the way human beings are. People love to shame people. Fat shaming is a horrible thing. I mean, Carl was at one time overweight, as equally as overweight as I was, and he got the weight down. He lost in mass over 100 pounds, and he kept them off until the day he died. He was overweight at the same time, and then he once you've lost 100 pounds, you become a different person. I've seen other people lose weight like that. They become the human beings that, you know, it's almost a Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde transformation. Thus, the concentration on clothing and vanity becomes a priority, and perhaps the real values about friendship just go to the wayside because you're so impressed with losing 100 pounds. And he was a great friend. He was a great teacher and a great friend. I mean, we spoke the same language. I go back to that. The people that I've come across in my life, we've spoken the same language, be it about fashion, art, painting, poetry, literature. We simply spoke the same fashion, the same language, the same vocabulary.
That was an excerpt from my 2020 conversation with Andre Leontali, who died Tuesday, the former Vogue creative director and longtime fixture and force in the fashion world, was 73.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.